IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome once again to episode 70 of the Killing It
Podcast.
And you guys are waiting longer and longer. You've got this super delay that you've now built into this.
Dramatic pause.
Oh, dramatic pause. That's
or
right.
emphasis.
I thought it was
trying to be theatrical.
You weren't paying attention. So this is the Killing It Podcast. I'm Carl. And obviously today, again, joining me are Dave and Ryan. And we literally spent 52 minutes talking before we started the recording. So,
so many things going on.
The pre-show is longer than the show, almost by double.
And we didn't actually talk about any of these topics, so we don't even know what each other's going to say, which is even weirder.
Hey, it's at least spontaneous, everybody. You're getting our reactions in real time, as opposed to like thinking we all warmed it up. Now we covered all kinds of other just topics.
And just because Dave needs to hear this out there in public, 3D printing is coming back.
Be continued.
Preview that one.
So just a quick note. So Ryan appeared at the SMB roundtable within my community this week. Dave was on the Channel Pro podcast last week, and I'll be on it. Well, I was on it, I guess, this week. So we're just like out there in the community. So if you see us, remember to, you know, like it, thumbs up and all that, and tell your friends about the Killing It Podcast.
We do appreciate it. The momentum's continue good, but we're loving the larger conversation. And I think particularly as we've all shifted a little bit and we're having these conversations in new ways, the opportunity to do it in this format and have ongoing conversations has been super fun. And I know we all appreciate it.
Yeah. And I will say, as a validation of the original premise behind this program, there are many very cool conversations going on around the industry. And if you could only just be a fly on the wall and hear what smart people are saying about these things, I continue to get echoes in other podcasts from other communities that come back and talk about things that we're talking about. And I go, ooh, I want to get in on that one. That's right. Really exciting. It is very cool to connect the dots. So like keep those referrals and those connections coming, because that stuff is it's very gratifying to see how many people are thinking about these topics.
Speaking of topics.
Well, so we're going to kick in on the first one, and I'll do the introduction. This is a piece from the Wall Street Journal, which we'll include the link in the show notes. And it's talking about venture capital funding on U.S. startups having declined in the first half of the year. And the idea here is that the pandemic is causing investors to shy away from those risky bets on smaller firms and untested technologies, and instead they're pouring cash into proven ventures. And the quote that hit me is, "Now is an atrocious time to be looking to raise money." And I thought that it's an interesting perspective on things, because, you know, obviously this is a time, an interesting time, and I'm the first one to rant that I think the stock market is completely divorced from the rest of the economy. You cannot measure the economy based on the stock market. But then to hear venture capital having, you know, essentially pulling back on its risk tolerance, I thought that was kind of interesting, particularly because I feel like, while yes, I would say, you know, be conservative, these are exactly the people that I would be expecting to place bets, because I think that some of the most interesting creativity and the most difficult, like, you know, startups that are created in downtimes tend to be the most resilient. So I'm a touch surprised to see VCs pull back. You know, then again, they're not nearly as smart as everyone thinks they are.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that a lot of smart people do in recessions is they use this as the opportunity to buy, right? Like you look at, for example, in the last recession, a lot of companies had gone bankrupt laying down fiber. And so there was dark fiber all over the place.
Right.
And companies literally were able to buy it 10 cents on the dollar. and then light it up and make a ton of money. So, you know, if you want somebody else to do all of your investing for you, recessions are an opportunity to go on a buying spree. So it's interesting to see venture capitalists not investing in new ventures that are out there. And even though they're kind of on sale, right? If you're laying off technicians and you're laying off employees, you probably have a leaner, meaner operation than you might have had before. So it's kind of interesting. So I wonder if those venture capitalists are investing in something else.
Well, and that's the thing, right? It is very rare for them to invest in one type of thing. And it is equally understandable that they may go beyond one industry and be looking for growth. But I tend to fall down where you are, Dave, that I think this is an indication of more fear, less boldness than just capitalizing on a few known investments, right? The old cliche is desperation is the mother of invention, and you should expect to see very many new interesting things happen when old assumptions crumble. And we've done nothing for the last 4 months except crumble old assumptions across all kinds of industry segments. You should expect there to be a whole bunch of newly entrepreneurial people looking around going, well, I used to have a gig. Now I'm looking for a new gig. Let's invent something from scratch. That's just not getting funded. And I think it has some 2 years down the road implications that you could expect a little bit of a lull in the pipeline of new commercializable investments. I've seen reports that corporate R&D is actually suffering in the mega, innovation category, VC in the super small innovation category. And we're starting to see just fewer categories have net new entrants. 2 years ago, what we were all talking about in the VC world was, is it equal? Is it fair? Does everybody have access? Right now, the question is, does anybody have access? And I have a little bit more pessimistic view on the VC behavior, perhaps, than others do. But I also 100,000% agree with you. The stock market is not measuring the economy. The stock market is measuring harvesting by the top 1%. And God bless them to harvest. That's cool. But that's not the economy.
They are living their best lives up there. Good on you. But I mean, look, the piece that's interesting about this is that it's my experience that businesses built in downtimes are actually some of the strongest ones that come out. Now, admittedly, a factor of that is because of being lean, of being forced to make do with less. Look, if VCs don't want to put their money on these things because they will create lean ideas that survive, and they will then pay a premium to get involved with those later because those founders have figured out that that you are able to do it without them. So that if they can get out of the womb, that'll be a good time for them. I get it. I get the idea of being conservative. I implore everybody to be careful with their cash flow, but I want to make sure that the thinking is not just the be so concerned that you don't invest, because if you can, those that push forward, if they invest some in R&D, that come up with a good idea and execute now, man, they're going to come out strong and roaring on the other side of it.
One of the things that the article sort of alludes to but doesn't actually say is that, in an era where everybody's doing everything remotely, it may be people who are really good at Zoom are getting more money than people who are not good at Zoom, right? If you have to do your pitch for whatever, $20 million over Zoom, it's going to be very different than doing it in a boardroom with, shaking people's hands and slapping them on the back.
Yep, I would agree with that. And again, I agree with the idea. And in fact, there is hard data, Dave, to back up your premise. Firms founded in a recession tend to grow faster and weather future recessions much more robustly. That is well established in 2008, in 2001, and even back into the 90s. And I'm thinking right now data just specifically in the technology industry. But that is not just an idea. That is very well established, even by some of the biggest players in our space. I do think, though, that that speaks to a whole new set of skills, right? Carl, to your point, there once was a way that follow this formula and you will get yourself some funding. Okay, cool. So apparently that is also a crumbling assumption, that the way that you do these things needs to be different. And, you know, again, Uncle Charles Darwin did not say survival of the fittest. He said survival of the most adaptive. And that is where we are. Can you thrive in this new world? And I don't think market leadership is a safe assumption.
So final note on this, I just want to point out that the weird word that stood out in this article, which is acqui-hire, which is like, I guess a term meaning acquiring employees by buying the company they work for. And it's called acqui-hire.
Or a talent acquisition. That's another way that I've heard
talent
that.
There. Actually, those are words I actually understand.
But we like making up words.
Exactly.
How about we make up money, right? that's our next topic. Ryan, you want to introduce this one?
No, I do.
Carl, sorry, this is Carl.
So one of the things that we've talked about from time to time is cryptocurrency, and there's kind of a misleading headline from Forbes about, you know, that MasterCard and Visa and PayPal are changing their tune on Bitcoin and crypto. But the real story is that they're not actually changing their mind on Bitcoin at all, but they are adopting cryptocurrencies. It's basically they're now creating their own. They're each creating their own. And I love this quote, money is nothing but alphanumeric data, and it would become alphanumeric data, not in paper form, but in a form arranged with electrons and photons. So, you know, part of what's interesting for me about this is that Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, they're all creating their own, right? JP Morgan, there's going to be a lot of cryptocurrencies, and it's basically their own way of creating a blockchain embedded ledger system for managing their money, right? If I send you money, it disappears from my bank account in 1 second, but you may not get it for 3 days. That is purely a matter of banks choosing to delay that money. There's no economic reason for it other than, hey, when they keep this money for a few days, they can do something else with it.
Well, and on top of that, think about the way that a bank works, right? So, I mean, it's because, you know, you give the bank your money, but it's not like your money sits in an isolated little corner of the world and sits by itself. No, it goes into the giant pile of money that they have that they deploy in various ways, right? You get an IOU that says you've got that money with them, and if you'd like some of it back, you have scored to it. It disappears into the bank, and then when I need it, it comes back out again. So ultimately, if they put it in their, quote unquote, put it in their own crypto, okay, that's just a different version of the ledger system and probably a more secure one that they can manage. It's probably not ever going to be something that really fluctuates, right? Because it's pegged to the US dollar or whatever currency the bank works in. It's just ultimately a new ledger system. Now, it sounds cooler to say we're converting this to our own cryptocurrency.
Right. Rather than just saying blockchain.
Right, but I'm never going to actually use like the Visa coin or that's not the way that it works. The way that it works is that the transaction gets put into their blockchain, tracked through the whole process, and comes still back out on the other side as US dollars or whatever currency.
And if it is operational efficiency and ledger accuracy and confidence, like that's a good enough reason for them to do that internally. If they can eliminate risk and they can eliminate cost of operations, then by all means invest in this new technology. But I cannot believe that they don't also have much larger ambitions, even though they won't admit to them right up front. In exactly the same way that Apple Pay and Zelle and Venmo are competing for, hey, it's just a way to make this digitally convenient for you, my customer, .. and for me to eventually be the one platform on which all transactions occur because I can out-execute, I believe, any of those competitors. absolutely these banks wish to get to a place where you are spending Visa dollars, Visa coins, instead of the underlying stuff. What I find interesting about it is that the internal efficiencies make a lot of sense. It's the exchange efficiencies that I wonder who's going to blink first, because you know the reason that I would digitize everything for bank-to-bank transactions, exactly as Carl described. If I am the receiver, I would like to get that stuff today, not three days from now, 3 years from now. I would like to get that money right now, because the sooner it's in my bucket, the faster I can begin to earn interest on it. The one who's sending it, they don't ever want to realize a transaction in real time, because that's the thing. If you understand the calculation of days sales out and the impact on working capital, this is that writ very, very large. If I collect the money from you in a day and I don't pay it out until 3 days, collect it instantly, those 72 hours, to you and me and our bank account balance, I might go, what? I earned an extra like 3.2 cents in interest on the money. Yeah, but multiply that by a trillion and now you're talking real dollars.
Well, you and I don't have access to the federal funds rate, right? I mean, these banks loan each other billions of dollars every day for a few hours at a time. Like,
yep.
And that makes a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon it adds up to real money. Well, I do want to say, Dave, I almost feel like we should link to It's a Wonderful Life, because you had like this description of the Home Loan Association. Well, you know, that's not your money. We give that money to Ryan to put in his house.
It's so true. I mean, but the other thing about this is think about it from their investments in fraud protection. Like if you're making even small adjustments to fraud, to the ability to track down fraud, that is real significant money for them. So the ability to do better tracking, better ledger control, whatever we want to call it, to the currency that flows in and out of these systems and be able to track it and potentially even pull it back, like undo transactions is one of the ideas that's manageable with this. Like you totally see why they're interested in this.
And along those lines, I saw an FBI agent do a presentation about a year ago, and he said it was super important that if you get ripped off, you know, that you get one of these phishing attacks or whatever, and you report it to the FBI, within hours, they can actually get your money back. 24 hours later, it is gone. It has been transferred and transferred and transferred, and once it hits overseas, it's gone. And so this is the kind of thing where it's like, okay, maybe we can make a dent in that. Maybe we can stretch that out instead of hours to being a day.
Well, but again, right, to that point, there's an internal fraud control and an external fraud control. If you can chase it down in minutes instead of hours and you don't lose it overseas, excellent in an external fraud case. Internal fraud, internal shenanigans, right? Like there's tremendous inefficiency in the machine. I have a brother-in-law who is a compliance chief in the financial services industry. He and all of his peers in that industry exist because we admit that even when the rules are there, the rules are not always followed and not always nefariously, occasionally just mistakes, but there's a tremendous amount of friction internally in financial services. And if you can automate that stuff with a crypto ledger, I think that you will find that the savings in a bank are not millions, they are billions when you get to an annual basis.
So, but the one thing I want to leave a little bit of a takeaway, because we've been asked about crypto before. We have actually, so I wanted to say, like, I'm very intrigued by blockchain as a technology and the way digital ledgers can be really used and leveraged. But I want to point out that I am not that big on Bitcoin and their own standalone coins. And I just go, that's just all speculative craziness. And I don't really see a lot of value to that. So I'm divorcing those implementations from the technology. And I want you to, you know, so make sure that when you're having these conversations and you're thinking about blockchain and you hear those descriptions, make sure that you do separate out the technology from the various implementations as you do.
Right. And I guess, you know, final note on this is that when companies like JP Morgan and even Amazon create these things, part of what they want to do is be able to move their money across international lines. And if they do it on the up and up, it will be very visible, taxed if necessary, and so forth. Bitcoin is kind of designed to not do that.
Right.
Not be visible and not be taxable. And so, you know, at some point, Bitcoin will be, you know, we talk about the two internets, right? Well, there's going to be the legal and the illegal cryptocurrencies, basically. And I think Bitcoin is going to head towards, you know, the dark side.
Well, and Carl, excellent professional segue there, because our third topic that I will tee up here in the conversation speaks to the world of the splinternet and the international economic implications of all of these e-commerce platforms. In fact, the article that we're going to link to here, it extends a concept we've been talking about for a while, and it makes it into some really like blow your mind kinds of dimensions. Not just the splinternet of two, authoritative versus democratic, as we've described it before, but four of them. And what's fascinating to me is that the distinctions are not just political. They are still. They are not only political. They are primarily financial and economic, right? We think of the internet in this industry as a technology platform for data transfer and systems integration so that we can facilitate business process. The way that this article describes it, we are now thinking of the internet primarily as a transactional environment where we do commerce. And then, by the way, underneath that, you can use it for some business process purposes. I found this just absolutely mind-stretching, and I think everybody needs to kind of rethink how we do regulation, because the one objection, and I will say right up front in this conversation that I had with the article, he describes one of the problems with the approach that we use here in America for our regulatory schemes on the internet and whatever. He said, oh, it's all good stuff. I think it's terrific, except for just, you know, that one tiny little quibble of, you know, it might be anti-competitive and it might prevent new firms from starting up or entering. That is not a quibble. That is a fundamental flaw
right. In
our approach to the regulation. But beyond that, what it says is, and I mean, I'd love to get you guys' thoughts on this. The U.S. model is very commercially friendly. The Chinese model is deliberately isolated, but still very commercially effective inside their system. The new challenger coming up on the outside, challenging for the lead position. The Indian model to the internet, model to the internet is radically differently architected. And based on this analysis, I kind of feel like it might be the one that wins in the end. What do you guys think?
I just want to take a minute and say the fourth model is the European model, which, you know, we've talked about as well, that it's really about, its differentiator is about privacy. And this article sort of suggests it's the losing model because it's too restrictive. Where the U.S. is probably too open, the European model is a little too restrictive. The Indian model is interesting in part because it's a mix between the Chinese control model and the U.S. open model. You know, don't forget, they did shut down internet access to a large part of their own society based on internal squabbles and some internal revolutions that they were having.
Yeah, they are squarely in the authoritarian camp of the splinternet.
Well, so the interesting thing to me is that I'm, you know, one of the things that I didn't like about this article, it's very mind-blowing and it gives a lot of good perspective. But what I didn't is I think the article is super dismissive of of any of the ideas of human rights and privacy at all. It's essentially, it's like, well, that's bad for commerce. And it just sort of throws it all aside, thinking that, you know, it's my, and I, you know, I know I beat on this analogy all the time. It's, yeah, but so is dumping chemicals in the water is bad for commerce too. But some of us like clean water. Like, it's, and I think that that dismissiveness of, well, you know, it's all just, all these European ideas are all just bad. Like, you know, I like the idea of actually having some privacy, like actually having some ownership.
Well, but so now that you've done this 2 weeks in a row, point out, not every regulation is good. So just because you have regulation doesn't mean it's a good regulation.
Right? I totally agree.
I like clean water. That doesn't mean every water regulation that you come up with is
no. But the absolute absence of regulation and the approach of self-regulation, as I've said before, I don't buy it.
Right, and Carl, and I'm actually in agreement with you. But what I think the article is dismissive of is that sort of gap between saying, like, okay, you know, every regulate, like, here are the bad regulations, here's no regulation. There is a gap in there of good. Like, there is a gap in there.
And if you look at these models, the European model is the least oppressive in terms of limiting, you know, what people can do with this. As long as you are cool with the privacy piece of it, go sell stuff, go download pornography, go do whatever makes you happy. Where the Chinese model is very, very regulated. I mean, when I was in Cambodia, there was real clear discussion, please don't discuss these things or post these things because you are being monitored, right? And you're being monitored basically because we bought all of our equipment from Huawei.
Right. And so I guess, you know, but first of all, I do think that there is something really interesting to look at from the Indian model. And I also think that this is one of the things that I wanted people to walk away from this discussion is, you know, we've been talking about the bifurcation in this binary sense. And I think it's more important to think about it from this sort of, you know, 4-point sense. It's still the same thematic idea, but it adds a level of complexity that I think is really valuable, actually, is to look at the various economic factors and say, like, okay, now I understand there are differences to them. It is not two polar extremes, that we can actually play with this more multidimensionally.
It and would be interesting to see how you could get the contract for the web overlaid onto each of these models and whether it would still fit. And I will just add, I'm also going to link to the model about the US developing quantum computers and an internet based on quantum computers. And if that becomes a fifth internet, there will quickly become probably a Russian version, a Chinese version, and an Indian version of, you know, the quantum internet as well. And I don't know
how much
different that's going to be.
But that could be just a technology implementation that allows for additional speed that's then following the economic models of the other
four. But remember, the internet we have now started out as research, either military or academic research, but it started out as the research of computers.
As with everything that that NASA ever created that became a successful consumer product, that is a good incubation model, but it's the inevitable end result of the research implementation. To Dave's point, right, where there is one axis of regulation, authoritative versus democratic, there is a second axis of the economic model, whether it is very laissez-faire or very structured and restricted access. And those, in the true spirit of a real consultant, that becomes a 4-box matrix, right? Like, that is two different axes where we're now looking at it in the dimensions of the government approach to your access to information versus the economic access to audience and opportunity. And now you're going to have a lower left and an upper right, and internets can be understood within that kind of a dimension model. What I find absolutely fascinating, though, is just the impact that the accelerating technologies will have, right? To Carl's point, whether it's quantum infrastructure or it's 4G becoming 5G connecting pipes, if yours is a really interesting regulatory environment and things are 10,000 times slower. I don't care how cool your regulation benefits are. I'm going to go to the one that is radically faster, right? So I think we're going to get some silly acceleration in performance, but they all still have to live within a world of, can you set up a business in there and can you have access to information?
Here's the interesting thing about this increased speed. If it is just, quote unquote, just technological, you could have the possibility of filtering as things go into Europe, all the lights go off about, oh, sorry, you can't pass that data. It's got private information. As things flow in and out of China, all the lights go off. Oh, sorry, you can't have this content or that content. As things flow in and out of India, you see what I mean? Like,
yep.
You see, could have like the biggest list of router rules you've ever seen in your life.
you could bring it back into one master internet to rule them all. But to Dave's point, right? God bless the Europeans for having some conscience on privacy and data regulation. If we can find the commercially friendly ways to implement those things, every one of us would prefer to live in a world where not just Facebook, Amazon, Google, et cetera, have way too much access to your private data, but also foreign governments, right? Those things all need to be controlled. And in the article, again, to Dave's point, his very flippant toss aside of, I mean, yeah, it's like good for the people to have privacy, but not if I can make more money off of it. It's like,
right. And it's like, come on, buddy. So let me make it a little tactical for people in terms of the why I think this thematic is so important is I think that there is incredible value in solution providers working with their customers to start understanding what data the customer is collecting on their customers, what is being managed, how it's being managed, and thinking about your approach. Because you oftentimes have too many conversations around, let's back it up, let's make sure it's covered from a disaster, let's protect it from a security perspective. But I don't think there's enough conversation of, what are you collecting? Are you collecting the right stuff and only the right stuff and not too much data to put yourself out of liability and a risk? And it opens up this other can of worms of beyond that. And I think that those conversations are way more valuable than just basic ones. And that's why I want people to be thinking about it.
Very good. And as usual, we will revisit this one for sure. As the next time it'll be 8 internets and then it'll be 16 and on we go.
And then it'll just keep devolving into every network block.
So that will do it. So we're now at 70 and we can see episode 75. It's just right around the corner. We'll celebrate then. In the meantime, this has been episode 70 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.